The decade after the Second World War was a time of extraordinary cultural richness in Britain. It was the era of Peter Grimes and Vaughan Williams' Sixth Symphony, of Brideshead Revisited and The End of the Affair, of the Third Programme and the emergence of Francis Bacon. But perhaps no art form flourished like the cinema. A trip to the pictures was a staple of weekly life. In 1946, there were 1.635 billion cinema admissions in Britain, the most ever. The type of film people saw reflected a society war had changed profoundly. Taboos the British cinema had left untouched could no longer be ignored because they were more apparent in the upturned post-war world and demanded attention if film was to remain relevant. Families had broken up because of bereavement and adultery. What had passed for the moral code of a supposedly Christian nation had been tested. Even the best regulated families had difficulties. Matters considered subjects of shame and unsuitable for a cinema audience, carnal irregularities, criminality, revenge, failings in the justice system, even disability, suddenly became popular with British screenwriters and studios. The period between 1945 and 1955 was when the British cinema started to grow up. The films reflected a world that existed, rather than one self-appointed moral arbiters wished existed. The treatment of class became radically different. Working-class people had usually appeared as caricatures, chirpy, cheeky, cheerful Cockney chappies, rough-cut spivs, professional northerners, or housewives polishing doorsteps, while ending sentences with the refrain, "I don't mind if I do, I'm sure." Now, after a second war that they had largely helped win, they had to be depicted with minds of their own. As with the upper and middle classes, some were good, and some were downright bad. It's a popular misconception that this transformation happened at the end of the 1950s, with a wave of kitchen sink dramas. Those who think that can't have seen Robert Hamer's stunning film noir of 1947, It Always Rains on Sunday. But then, the British cinema didn't do film noir either, did it? Hamer was bisexual, with a growing drink problem, and brought a mathematician's precision and a poet's touch to his work. He was the most original directorial talent then working in Britain, whatever fans of Michael Powell and David Lean might argue. He combined acute visual sense with a regard for and an understanding of the English language, matched by none of his rivals. He was also prepared to test and cross boundaries and infuriate his boss at Ealing, Michael Balkan. These talents would reach their apotheosis 2 years later, when he both directed and largely wrote Kind Hearts and Coronets. It Always Rains on Sundays is at the opposite extreme from Edwardian wit, elegance, sumptuousness and subversiveness. It's set in Bethnal Green, grim in that age of austerity, even on days when it didn't rain, and in the heart of the working class. It's a world of shrewish housewives, spivs, chancers, petty thugs, and, charged with maintaining something like the ordered society, avuncular but determined policemen. But it's also a world whose very bleakness seems to work to persuade all its denizens that no one has to accept his or her lot. Breaking out of one's settled life isn't always to be done by conventional means. For some in the film, mainly the men, the only way they can imagine escaping is by acts of criminality, though the film is careful to show that crime doesn't pay. For others, mainly the women, the escape route is an improper, indeed dangerous, relationship. The message is that existence is so dull, so hard, so routine, so relentless, that morality in all its forms must be cast aside in the search for something if not better, then less tedious. It Always Rains on Sunday is a morality tale. The moralities in question being not just that crime doesn't pay, but that stepping outside the cosy and conventional world of marriage can be a poor idea too. The film tells the story of an escaped convict, Tommy Swan, who returns to his East End manor to raise the means to flee abroad. Hamer lays the rules of morality out in the film in a way that he explicitly does not in Kind Hearts. Kind Hearts is a subversive film precisely because it plays fast and loose with traditional concepts of right and wrong, and indeed of the entire social order. Nothing of the sort happens in It Always Rains on Sunday. What's right and what's wrong are abundantly clear, and evil doesn't triumph. There's a class issue at play, too. The sophisticated, educated classes who people Kind Hearts have the philosophical armoury to explore and challenge morality. The working classes of It Always Rains on Sunday may not be caricatures and may have minds of their own, but they still lack self-discipline and trustworthiness, and therefore require an element of social control. They can't be allowed the luxury of having their morality made flexible. This film is essentially about their doomed attempts to break free from that control and the inevitable reassertion of order. Rose Sandygate, superbly played by Googie Withers, is a retired barmaid who goes into her Anderson shelter one wet Sunday morning to find Swan, her former boyfriend, who she thought was doing a stretch on the moor for robbery with violence, hiding in there. As that morning's news of the world has, to her great discomfort, already told her, Swan, played by Withers' husband in real life, John McCullum, has escaped from Dartmoor and returned to London. In a flashback, we see Swan in his earlier incarnation as an East End spiv, brill-creamed to within an inch of his life, and wearing the sort of double-breasted suit that shouldn't be allowed out without a licence. He exudes deceit and vulgarity. Now he is ragged, exhausted, frightened, and desperate. The swagger we see briefly in the flashbacks is gone. If anything, this makes him a nastier piece of work, even than he was before, though the violence he used in the smash-and-grab raid that put him in prison was sufficiently extreme to get him a dose of the cat-of-nine-tails, the standard punishment for armed robbery, and only abolished the year after this film came out. Hamer balances Swan's phony glamour with other, even less attractive aspects of his character. He's depicted as small-minded, self-pitying about his punishment and his fate, self-obsessed and loyal only to himself. Thanks to the flashbacks, we see a romanticised past that explains Rose's infatuation with him. A confident, almost suave chat-up line in the pub, an idyllic day in the country, and Rose, a bottle blonde then, a natural brunette now, a conscious downgrading of reality, unaware of how her beau earns his living. The landlord of her pub tells her Swan has been arrested for robbery with violence. Her dreams suffer a smash-and-grab raid, similar to that of the jewellers Swan had targeted. She marries a portly, middle-aged, reliable and decent widower, and assumes a measure of responsibility for his adolescent children. The predictable, safe, boring alternative to the life that might have been with Tommy Swan. That she married him is a sign that Rose, too, has grown up, and the appeal of the Tommy Swans of this world is apparent only to the easily deceived or those without morality. As Rose eventually shows, she does have the latter. Swan doesn't offer Rose an escape with him, but makes it clear, while he hides in her house on this wet Sunday, that he'd like to seduce her, for old time's sake. Rose has a momentary lapse, and doesn't seem to find the prospect unpleasant. But with her husband and stepchildren in and out, such a dangerous luxury isn't feasible. It takes all Rose's mental and quite a lot of her physical energy to keep Swan concealed. When he has to make a run for the docks, her genuine pain at losing him contrasts with his utter ruthlessness in seeking to save his own skin. When she attempts to argue with him, he knocks her senseless. Any member of the audience who has hitherto harboured any sympathy for this revolting figure is unlikely to retain it beyond that point. In our age, inured to the pornography of violence, we should remember that a man beating a woman on celluloid retained the power to shock and disgust in 1947. But the film is not just about this important, fractured, and in the end abusive relationship. Other struggles are going on in parallel that flesh out more of the detail of the arduousness of life in bombed-out, austerity London. There appears to be little in the way of honest endeavour in Bethnal Green. Even those who seem to be running legitimate businesses, whether shops or market stalls, have an inevitable attraction towards merchandise off the back of the proverbial lorry, though one of the subplots, about three pathetic trainee criminals and their difficulty in offloading a consignment of bent roller skates, shows criminality was not their ideal vocation. The criminal world is shown to have its own hierarchy, with the people nearer the top being shrewd hypocrites, and careful always to have others do their dirty work for them. Lou Hyams, meticulously played by John Slater, bestows patronage on young people and drops 50 quid on the local vicar for his boys' club, but rigs boxing matches and buys stolen goods, including the aforementioned roller skates, for a song to make his living. Hamer makes clear Hyams' exploitation of those below him in the pecking order, not just by the smoothness of his spiv's mannerisms and vocabulary, a sharply stereotypical depiction that some might feel verges on anti-Semitism, but also by the metaphor of clothes. The rain drenches the three petty thieves who steal the roller skates, their tatty, cheap suits shiny and wet. Hyams, by contrast, wears a coach-built, double-breasted overcoat that would serve as a protection against a nuclear explosion, never mind a cloudburst. Should we be inclined to think that Hyams' material success suggests that crime is, after all, a commendable way of life, the sheer loathsomeness of his character is enough to make him a figure utterly unworthy of envy. Hyams' brother Morrie is the most comical character in the film. He runs a record shop, and also a low-rent dance band, a poor man's Henry Hall in white tie and boiled shirt. He fancies himself with the ladies and is billed as the man with sax appeal. Glamorous only to the young and impressionable, he reels in Rose's pretty but deluded stepdaughter, Vi. It's not just the morality tale aspect of Hamer's work that gives this film value. It's a gruesomely realistic picture of low life in London, and supremely evocative of the drabness that the popular imagination has it was the leitmotif of that era. It also has strong elements of a thriller. We always feel Swan is a loser. It's only he, with his titanic arrogance and stupidity, who seems unable to see that. But while we feel he's certain to fail in his attempt to elude justice, we don't know how that failure will seal itself. The denouement of the film is a set piece of noir, with the fugitive pursued through the East End in a car chase, on foot, and then through a massive goods yard in the dead of night. He jumps from train to train, rolling away from locomotives, intent on mowing him down. We sense he won't get away, and we can't even be sure he'll escape with his life. In the end, he does survive, delivered into the arms of the policeman who has pursued him throughout that long, wet Sunday, played by Jack Warner. Who else? Swan's fantasies of a new life on the Cape, perhaps even one in which he sends for Rose, are over. It's back to the moor for him for even longer than expected. The boundary between right and wrong has been reaffirmed. Order is restored, and the moral framework of society, so shaken by the war, is intact, although only just. One vignette in the film suggests, though, that nothing much will change. A small boy wants a harmonica for Morrie's shop, but lacks the money. He then sees Morrie kissing Vi, who happens to be his sister, and makes it clear that his lips can be sealed only by the gift of the harmonica. The blackmail works. No wonder, we reflect, that Morrie's business is doing so badly, and no wonder a demoralised people see no real need, generation upon generation, to remoralise themselves. It Always Rains on Sunday may have a moral ending, but it doesn't have a happy one.